listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A federal grand jury indicted 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities with accusations that they interfered with the U.S. election in 2016. However, the complaint did not contain any allegations that the efforts of the parties influenced the outcome of the election in 2016. The indictment accuses defendants of, quote, supporting the presidential campaign of then-candidate Donald J. Trump and disparaging Hillary Clinton, closed quote. It claims the defendants staged political rallies and bought political advertising while posing as grassroots entities. The document said an organization known as the Internet Research Agency, quote, sought in part to conduct what it called information warfare against the United States of America, closed quote, through fictitious U.S. personas on social media platforms and other Internet-based media. This was Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein at a press conference Friday.
Good afternoon. A grand jury in the District of Columbia today returned an indictment presented by the Special Counsel's Office. The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election. The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general. According to the allegations in the indictment, 12 of the individual defendants worked at various times for a company called Internet Research Agency, LLC, a Russian company based in St. Petersburg. The other individual defendant, Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin, funded the conspiracy through companies known as Concord Management and Consulting, LLC, Concord Catering, and many affiliates and subsidiaries. The conspiracy was part of a larger operation called Project Lacta. Project Lacta included multiple components, some involving domestic audiences within the Russian Federation, and others targeting foreign audiences in multiple countries. Internet Research Agency allegedly operated through Russian shell companies. It employed hundreds of people in its online operations, ranging from creators of fictitious personas to technical and administrative support personnel with an annual budget of millions of dollars. Internet Research Agency was a structured organization headed by a management group and arranged into departments, including graphics, search engine optimization, information technology, and finance departments. In 2014, the company established a translator project focused on the United States. In July of 2016, more than 80 employees were assigned to the translator project. Two of the defendants allegedly traveled to the United States in 2014 to collect intelligence for their American influence operations. In order to hide the Russian origins of their activities, the defendants allegedly purchased space on computer servers located here in the United States in order to set up a virtual private network. The defendants allegedly used that infrastructure to establish hundreds of accounts on social media networks such as Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, making it appear that those accounts were controlled by persons located in the United States. They used stolen or fictitious American identities, fraudulent bank accounts, and false identification documents. The defendants posed as politically and socially active Americans, advocating for and against particular candidates. They established social media pages and groups to communicate with unwitting Americans. They also purchased political advertisements on social media networks. The Russians also recruited and paid real Americans to engage in political activities, promote political campaigns, and stage political rallies. The defendants and their co-conspirators pretended to be grassroots activists. According to the indictment, the Americans did not know that they were communicating with Russians. After the election, the defendants allegedly staged rallies to support the president-elect while simultaneously staging rallies to protest his election. For example, the defendants organized one rally to support the president-elect and another rally to oppose him, both in New York on the same day. On September 13th of 2017, soon after the news media reported that the special counsel's office was investigating evidence that Russian operatives had used social media to interfere with the 2016 election, one defendant allegedly wrote, quote, "We had a slight crisis here at work. The FBI busted our activity. So I got preoccupied with covering tracks together with my colleagues," end quote. The indictment includes eight criminal counts. Count one alleges a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States by all of the defendants. The defendants allegedly conspired to defraud America by impairing the lawful functions of the Federal Election Commission, the United States Department of Justice, and the Department of State. Those organizations of the U.S. government are responsible for administering federal requirements for disclosure of foreign involvement in certain domestic activities. Count two charges conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud by Internet Research Agency and two of the individual defendants. And counts three through eight charge aggravated identity theft by Internet Research Agency and four individuals. Now, there is no allegation in this indictment that any American was a knowing participant in this illegal activity. There is no allegation in the indictment that the charged conduct altered the outcome of the 2016 election. I want to caution you that everyone charged with a crime is presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty in court. At trial, prosecutors must introduce credible evidence that is sufficient to prove each defendant guilty beyond any reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury. The special counsel's investigation is ongoing. There will be no comments from the special counsel at this time. This indictment serves as a reminder that people are not always who they appear to be on the internet. The indictment alleges that the Russian conspirators want to promote discord in the United States and undermine public confidence in democracy. We must not allow them to succeed. The Department of Justice will continue to work cooperatively with other law enforcement and intelligence agencies and with the Congress to defend our nation against similar current and future efforts. I want to thank the federal agents and prosecutors who are working on this case for their exceptional service, and I'll be happy to take a few questions.
Is there concern that this indictment undermines the outcome of the election?
What I have identified for you are the allegations in the indictment. There's no allegation in the indictment of any effect on the outcome of the election. Jessica.
On page 4 of the indictment, paragraph 6, it specifically talks about the Trump campaign, saying that defendants communicated with unwitting individuals associated with the Trump campaign. My question is, later in the indictment, campaign officials are referenced, not by their name, by campaign official 1 or 2 or 3. Were campaign officials cooperative, or were they duped? What was their relationship with this?
Again, there's no allegation in this indictment that any American had any knowledge. And the nature of the scheme was that the defendants took extraordinary steps to make it appear that they were ordinary American political activists, even going so far as to base their activities on a virtual private network here in the United States. If anybody traced it back to that first jump, they appear to be Americans. Catherine.
One more question. Have you had any assurances from the Russians that they will provide these individuals for prosecution?
But no communication with the Russians about this. We'll follow the ordinary process of seeking cooperation and extradition.
Thank you, Russia. Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, said the accusations of Russian meddling reflected the absurdity of the, quote, modern American political reality, closed quote. Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesperson for Russia's President Vladimir Putin, said that the Kremlin was, quote, not yet familiar, closed quote, with the indictments and had no further comment. Relations between the U.S. and Russia are at the lowest since at least 1991, when the Soviet Union was dissolved. It's in that context that the announcement by the Trump administration that it was moving ahead with former President Barack Obama's plans for a $1 trillion makeover of the U.S. nuclear arsenal has raised fears among those who follow such things. BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford spoke with one such person, Greg Mello, executive director of Los Alamos Study Group. Mello has reviewed the proposal and finds it very scary, noting that it was President Obama who was determined to create the present adversarial relationship with the Russians.
President Obama kind of talked left and cut right. The 2010 Obama Nuclear Posture Review made some dovish sounds, and I think that we could discuss at length how sincere they were, but it really doesn't matter. By the end of his administration, he had committed to a very large investment in nuclear weapons and hardly any nuclear disarmament. And within his administration, Russia phobes and hawks were gradually gaining ground until by the end it was all he could do to either wash his hands of some issues or try to restrain in a few places. So his policies ended up far more hawkish than his nuclear posture review. That's the place where Trump started. Trump's nuclear posture review takes that and adds more small usable nuclear weapons. The idea, which was always implicit, that the United States might use nuclear weapons in a conventional conflict up to that point, that's always been there. But Trump has kind of highlighted that and put some proposals for more usable nuclear weapons in there because they're terribly Russophobic and they're very concerned about the loss of power of the U.S. empire. And they think that nuclear weapons can somehow be a winning weapon.
Yes, Trump is talking about nuclear retaliation for cyber attacks.
I think that for a lot of Americans, they haven't been really aware of what a potential first-use policy of nuclear weapons really entails. It means using nuclear weapons because a non-nuclear attack has occurred somewhere, either attack on the United States of some nature, like a cyber attack, or an attack on U.S. troops somewhere where they might lose, or U.S. ships. So that's always been there, but Trump has showcased it to an alarming degree.
Yes, the U.S. has never forsworn first strike. And in fact, standard U.S. nuclear posture back in the day was to respond in nuclear fashion if there were a massive conventional Soviet attack in Western Europe.
Exactly. And the basic idea remains the same. The circumstances are a little different. The cyber attack has somewhat taken the place of an attack in Europe, although I suppose an attack in Europe is back on the table because we are very much creating mischief wherever we can in the immediate area of Russia, especially Ukraine right now.
Yes, in today's world, the Russians, not Soviets anymore, would only have to cross their own border to confront NATO.
Correct. We just kept expanding NATO. It started with a Democrat, Bill Clinton, in second term, and it's gone on ever since. And Russia feels very much cornered. They don't like to see panzer divisions on their western border, which was intentionally done to send a signal. You know, that's the kind of thing that these neoconservatives that are scattered throughout government and in high places, people have told me that they just love that. They just want to do things to drive Russia crazy.
I'm a senior citizen, and all of my life, the Republicans have been considered the more hawkish, but that has changed.
Absolutely, it has. And I feel the same way, Glenn, and it's kind of, it's something we talk about and try to deal with all the time, and how liberals, progressives have become manipulated to be the tacit allies of the military-industrial complex in vilifying Russia, which has no factual basis. And of all the things that we should be working on, the justice issues, the climate change, making sure that we have a social contract in this country, for some reason, we're mobilizing to vilify Russia and protect the FBI, of all things. We don't have any real organized senior level Democratic Party opposition to war at this point.
And that includes Bernie Sanders, who has very little to say about foreign policy. And when he does speak, he's hawkish as well.
That's quite true. I saw an essay not too long ago, just a few days ago, that has been rolling around in the back of my mind that some of our progressive leaders are in many ways like liberal Republicans of the 1950s, like Eisenhower. And I haven't really assessed the full truth of that or absorbed it, really, but I know there is at least some truth to that, if not a lot.
Well, certainly the alliance between the top of the Democratic Party, as personified by Hillary Clinton, became evident in the campaign with the CIA and other intelligence operatives becoming quite politicized in their support for the Clinton candidacy.
Totally true. And this phenomenon is very new to our experience, where there's no check right now, no real check or balance. We've got a very short-circuited connection between the dominant media and ex-government officials and the intelligence agencies, so that these, like CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, become almost stenographic in their relaying of messages from deep state, if you want to use that term, the permanent foreign policy elite in the country. And there's a feedback that's going on from those media back to Congress. People are very busy. They don't have a lot of time to listen to and weigh alternative media. They read the New York Times and Washington Post while they're rushing to a midnight vote. So they think they know a lot of things which they don't know, which are not really true. So you've got Trump's volatility, and the people around him are, many of them, neoconservative, not all. And then the generals, which are all too prominent in this administration. And then on the other side, you have what? You have mild rebukes of nuclear policy, but, you know, really basically Democrats support about 90% of it. So there isn't really an opposition. And I'm hoping that we can all wake up before we pass watershed moments where it's much more difficult.
What kind of impact has this new nuclear posture had on Russian policy and pronouncements?
That's a very good question. And the idea of the authors is that Russia will essentially back down, that some of the worst parts of the nuclear posture review are fashioned as explicitly as bargaining chips, so that we would drop these ideas if Russia dropped, say, the caliber nuclear cruise missile, which could carry nuclear weapons. But it really isn't seen this way in Russia. Russia doesn't have the policy about nuclear weapons, which the nuclear posture review says it has. From the Russian perspective, they would only use nuclear weapons if they felt that their country was on the verge of being annihilated. So they feel that the ultimate goal of U.S. policy is some kind of regime change or degradation of sovereignty in Russia, which I think is correct. Henry Kissinger even said as much when Obama was in power. And so they would use nuclear weapons only if they felt the very existence of their country was at risk, which is very similar to the United States' perspective. In that case, they're not going to back down because we have an exact comparable nuclear weapon to theirs. It's just a fallacious idea, but one that happens to generate tens of billions of extra dollars to the nuclear weapons industries, and probably hundreds of billions for the defense industry in general.
You say that the goal, and that would be a bipartisan goal, is to break Russia. I suppose these folks think that they broke the Soviets and they can do it again with the present folks in the Kremlin.
Yes, I think that's correct. My conversations with people, including in the Obama White House, have left me with that strong impression. I think there's a whole generation of senior people in the Democratic Party who cut their teeth during the Clinton years, which is a fairly long time, that think that the normal state of the world is that the United States is basically in charge of Russia, and it's a less than fully sovereign country. And the prospect of Russia being fully sovereign, you know, it's stretching from Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific, from the Arctic to the Middle East, that is so horrifying to the neoconservatives that they feel that something has to be done, and that something is subjugation of Russia. But that is not going to happen.
And we've only been talking about Russia and the United States, but there are other nuclear powers, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and of course the U.S. allies, France and Britain.
Absolutely. Some of what's in the nuclear posture review is certainly related to the rise of China. The RAND Corporation did a study which only confirms what the person on the street would think as well, that Chinese military power is growing. The United States is not guaranteed to prevail in China in a war. So this also causes panic. And when arguing with people in Washington about whether to develop a new nuclear-tipped cruise missile, which is an Obama plan, the answer I got from an assistant secretary of defense was, well, we don't want Japan or South Korea to develop their own nuclear weapons, so we better do this to defend that region against China. That implies defending someone with a nuclear cruise missile implies a willingness to use it.
We all know that the military and politics are inextricably intertwined, but I get the impression that you believe that the U.S. nuclear posture is based much more on politics and ideology than on the science behind nuclear weapons and the science behind the livability of the planet.
It's a totally political document, ideological document. You know, the original drafters, people whose name was on the original drafts, were Keith Payne from the National Institute of Public Policy, who was very hard right ideologue in the Reagan administration. And so the origin of this document is really tied with the darkest times and ideas of the Cold War. And it was walked back from there by generals. And nowhere is there any kind of statesman-like understanding of the world as it is today and the existential issues facing humankind, any no kind of human solidarity or diplomacy. It's just all war all the time. It's a very relatively narrow echo chamber that produces this kind of document. You know, the people have a military background. They go to military colleges. They listen to the same think tanks. They spend their time with each other, and they reinforce each other's ideas. And they're not going out into either party, really, into understanding what the climate scientists are saying and what the needs of ordinary Americans are.
Well, we've always had Dr. Strangeloves in the military, but have the American people as a whole become inured to the prospect of nuclear annihilation and human extinction?
Geez, that's a scary idea, but it's an important question. To a certain extent, the apocalyptic imagination has become part of our mainstream zeitgeist through video games. Where I am in Albuquerque, there's a trampoline center which is called Fallout, and it's decorated on the inside with a mural showing a post-apocalyptic landscape of ruins where the city of Albuquerque used to be. So yes, I think we are getting numbed a little bit, and at the same time, we don't understand the reality of it all. Someone said to me recently that it's a little like if you've never been in a car accident of any kind, it may not seem real to you what can happen. And in a nuclear war is that many times over. We can't imagine what it would be like to have basically the sun appear over your city, something brighter than the sun at an altitude of a few hundred meters or a mile, burning everything up completely.
What would you like those of us who have not been numbed to the idea of being burnt to a cinder? What should we be doing? What should our response be?
We should be demanding dialogue with the Russians and to stop this ridiculous criminalization of diplomacy. We should be demanding a social contract that doesn't treat human beings like they're disposable. We should be demanding investments in renewable energy that create lots of jobs and career tracks for people, demand basically an end to the militarization of society and the beginning of a society based on solidarity and sustainability. We can do this in public in 100 different ways, from demonstrations at our congressional delegation offices, to letters to the editor, to study groups at churches and social organizations. It's hard for us. We can't even imagine giving up our big trucks or the way of life that we've had up to now. But, you know, we will if insist on trying to maintain a global empire. The world is very big. It's indomitable. We can't afford it. And the people who will pay the price are the people who have been paying the price all along. Only more so.
In general, folks seem to think that Donald Trump is more warlike and more likely to start a war than Barack Obama. Whether that's true or not, does that present a kind of opportunity for anti-war people to mobilize a public response to the U.S. war machine?
It does. It absolutely does. We can use the awareness of Donald Trump's volatility and the dominance of the military around him is an opportunity for us. But at the same time, we mustn't be naive and think that a person like Hillary Clinton, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, would be some kind of peacenik. Many of us were very concerned about Mrs. Clinton and her methodical, imperial, Russophobic willingness to intervene. The destruction of Libya, that's on her desk. She did that. So we can't be naive about the mainstream Democratic Party and just make this into an anti-Trump campaign.
That was Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group speaking from Albuquerque.
Meanwhile, this past week saw a meeting of the defense ministers of the NATO members in Brussels. Press TV's Jerome Hughes has more.
At a time when Russia is increasing its spending on defense, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg has warned that unless the Western bloc's budget is increased, its credibility will be seriously undermined because the alliance will not be able to purchase new equipment or increase its number of military exercises.
Sure that we are able to...
A whole range of issues were discussed during the two-day meeting of NATO defense ministers here in Brussels. The alliance is concerned that its role will be undermined if the new EU army, currently being established duplicates NATO's functions. 22 of the 29 countries in NATO are also members of the European Union.
They will really be the losers if they end up with two competing structures with two competing capability targets and lists. So this has to be coherent.
Stoltenberg has confirmed that just 8 NATO countries will meet their financial commitments to the alliance this year, despite huge pressure from Donald Trump for NATO members to pay more. Regarding tensions between NATO allies, the US and Turkey over Ankara's operations in Syria, Stoltenberg has called on Turkey to respond to security concerns in a measured way. The NATO ministers agreed to set up 2 new major bases in response to what they call a more assertive Russia. Those are likely to be located in the US and Germany. At the event, US Defense Secretary James Mattis accused Russia and Iran of playing destabilizing roles in the Middle East. Analysts say exactly the opposite is true, pointing out US-led forces were unable to defeat Daesh in Syria and Iraq.
When Russians begin with Syrian army, with even Hezbollah and Iranians to fight Daesh, we now see that Daesh is losing the war.
Top NATO officials are on tenterhooks, especially relating to the issue of funding, as they prepare for a summit this summer in Brussels, which will be attended by Donald Trump. The head of the alliance is most important.
So be very, very careful.
But now also its most unpredictable member. Jerome Hughes, Press TV at NATO headquarters, Brussels.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Who would have thought 13 Russians, 3 entities, and some cash could impact an American presidential election? This is where Russiagate stands today. Also, more twists and turns in the messy conflict known as Syria. Cross-talking those 13 Russians, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Alexander Mikuris. He is a writer on legal affairs as well as editor-in-chief of the Duran.com. And we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. As always, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to those 13 Russians, 3 entities, and all that cash. Maybe not so much cash. Alexander, you've been writing about it. From a legal perspective, give us your major takeaways.
Right. Well, the first point to say is that, of course, none of these people are going to be tried. So Mr. Mueller has prepared a very complicated, portentously worded indictment, which is never going to be tested.
Because there is no extradition law.
There's no extradition law. The Russians are not going to extradite these people. They're going to stay in Russia. So he doesn't have to prove any of the things that he has said. What seems to have happened is that some of these people have engaged in trolling on the internet, and they've done things which, let's be straightforward, are ugly things. Mr. Mueller.
But not unheard of.
But not unheard of.
And not just specifically to Russia,
and okay? Not specific to
it's
Russia
nothing
at
new
all.
Here.
Nothing new here at all. I mean, anybody who goes on the internet comes across trolls. What Mr. Mueller has done is he wants to prove that there is this vast, intricate, dangerous conspiracy. He's put all this together. He's labelled the internet agency in St. Petersburg as responsible. And he's trawled around for various laws that he can stick offences against these people on.
Essentially what this was, if you read the indictment, Mark, let me go to you, this was a commercial marketing, yeah, is what it was, and even the indictment itself admits that it was pro-anti-Trump, pro-anti-Hillary Clinton, and everything in between. Yeah. I mean, there's no specific political tilt to it.
There's no connections at all There's not even any alleged any connections between this supposed company, which is run by a guy who's known as Putin's chef because he ran a catering business before.
But that isn't even true.
That catering business is for Russian school children in Moscow. It's not about Putin. You know, it was just the liberal media in Russia that labeled him that.
And there's no connections at all to the Russian government. There's no connections at all to the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, or any of the other four people on completely unrelated and spurious charges that Mueller has charged any of the other four people who have been indicted on tax charges or anything else.
So we have four indictments before this. Now we have these indictments of 13 individuals
that will never be tried.
And three entities, and still none of them have any connection with the Russian government.
Trump or with any
or the Trump campaign.
Or any of the collusion plans.
It's enough that they were Russians, they were alive in 2016, and they posted something on Facebook that Americans could see.
Yes.
It doesn't matter that 95% of the European media was very pro-Hillary and anti-Trump during the campaign, and Americans could read millions of pages of their stuff during their campaign. That's not important. What is important is that these 13 Russians did it. Well, let me make this hilarious quote from Leonid Bershitsky. He is a writer.
Bloomberg.
He's a writer for Bloomberg. He used to be a liberal Russian journalist. Now he lives abroad. He writes about Russia just like Marcia Gessen. The difference is that he knows a thing or two about Russian history and literature, unlike Marcia Gessen. So here's what he wrote. I'm actually surprised. I haven't been indicted. I'm Russian. I was in the U.S. in 2016, and I published columns critical of both Clinton and Trump without registering as a Russian agent.
Okay, that goes to my next point. Alexander, given what we just heard from Dima, then Christopher Steele should be indicted as well. He's a foreigner. He wasn't registered as a foreign agent. He didn't report to the Federal Election Commission about what he was doing. I mean, this is a glaring...
And he lied.
Okay?
We've just got a confession. According to the actual terms of the indictment, Dmitry Babich is the unnamed 14th Russian troll.
Yes, because people in the United States...
Read the indictment, that could be very possible.
There could be millions.
Then let me go back to the Christopher Steele, because I think it's really important.
The question has been answered. I mean, all the things that people have been indicted for, Christopher Steele has done. He has lied to the FBI. He has interfered in the US election. He has done so secretly. He has been phoning up newspapers. He has been publishing information in a dossier that cannot be verified. He hasn't registered as any kind of foreign agent. And so why hasn't he been indicted? Why is there this resistance on the part of the Justice Department to indict him?
This is probably what I find most puzzling of all, Alexander, is the Trump's own DOJ and FBI. Maybe it's slightly different in the situation with the FBI, with the DOJ. Why isn't it moving there? That was a mystery to me.
Because it's not Trump's.
Yeah.
That answers the question.
We've talked about it plenty of times in this before. Trump has no power of his own administration. He's certainly given away foreign and military policy. His own Justice Department is pursuing him. And, you know, this cabal of generals, Mattis, McMasters, and Kelly, keeps him in a little playpen. And you know, his only real power is tweeting. And evidently, he's not allowed to do that whenever he wants as well.
Well, I mean, it's an attempt to use 19th century legislation to 21st century realities. I mean, in the 19th century, maybe it was illegal to bring pamphlets in favor of one of the candidates during the campaign. Now we live in an electronically interconnected world. If I want my American friends to read my opinion on Trump or on Hillary, I just post it on the internet. I post it on Facebook.
Because Facebook doesn't know, and Twitter doesn't know borders.
Absolutely.
That now makes you a criminal.
Exactly. But it makes me a criminal in the eyes of Mr. Mueller, right?
Okay, well, let's talk about election meddling. A couple of days ago on the Laura Ingraham program, the former head of the CIA, James Woesley, was on, and she asked a few questions about his reaction to the indictments, and then she talked about election meddling, but American election meddling abroad. Let's take a look.
Have we ever tried to meddle in other countries' elections? Oh, probably. But it was for the good of the system in order to avoid the communists from taking over. For example, in Europe in 47, 48, 49, the Greeks and the Italians,
we don't do
CIA.
That now, though. We don't mess around other people's elections, Joe.
Only for a very good
Can
cause.
Can you do that to them?
For a good
Ladies
cause.
And gentlemen, our good viewers, that was the former head of the CIA. Who wants to go first? Go ahead,
Dean. Well, James Wolves here. Let me speak about him in the way Western media speaks about Russia.
He's the former head of the CIA.
Former CIA colonel, you know, if we use the language that they use about Mr.
He's
Putin.
Not a colonel.
Okay, maybe a general. A former head of the Freedom House after that, who said in the early 2000s, Mr. Bashar al-Assad, Mr. Mubarak, we are coming after you. Which was actually true, you know. And he's not mad then. He's not interfering in other countries' elections. You know, just somehow the United States helped some Nazis come to power in Ukraine.
I think he famously
said
that Ukraine was the crown jewel. Mm-hmm. I mean, looking for forced regime, illegal change there. Alexander, react to that because, you know, they both chuckled, okay? I mean, for me, that's a jaw-dropping. You know, you're accusing a foreign country, and a very powerful one, Russia, of doing something against your country without any evidence whatsoever beyond a troll farm, okay? And there is ample evidence, mountains of evidence, the United States meddles in elections. It has for decades. And it's probably doing so exactly right now.
Well, indeed. When I was in Greece in 1968, when there was a coup, he refers to Greece. I was actually taken prisoner at the age of seven by the people who carried out the US-backed coup. And the house where we used to live was taken over by a family from the US Embassy. So it's not actually such a light-hearted or funny thing.
Well,
to
I mean, if you look at the entire segment, is that, you know, if the US does it, it's okay.
Well,
if anybody else does it, it isn't okay. That's the double standard, Mark.
Okay, Peter, if you could bear with me a little bit.
I think it's
time for a little bit of literature.
I know
review.
You're prepared. I know you're prepared.
All right. So this is about the projection from the U.S. onto other countries like Russia of what it does. The Guardian revealed U.S. spy operation that manipulates social media. This is from 2011. The U.S. military, the Pentagon, is developing software that it will let it secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online personas to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. And it specifically notes that the discovery that the U.S. military is doing this with fake online personalities, sock puppets, could also encourage other governments, private corporations, and government organizations to do the same.
Also, here, there was a program with on Twitter that does the same thing vis-a-vis Cuba.
Indeed, okay. And bear in mind, this is the U.S. military. What we've just heard alleged, there's no connection to the Russian
government. Next one, Mark. One more minute before we go to the break.
GHCQ, the British version of the National Security Agency, does the same thing, overwhelming evidence. We have a database from Carnegie Mellon using the U.S. government's own data. They've meddled in other elections 81 times only up to 2000, not counting coups and regime changes. And, of course,
the famous.
How can we forget this picture? Time magazine, Russia. The Americans openly helped Yeltsin in a rigged election keep power. Yanks to the rescue. They were quite proud about their meddling back then. They even made a movie, Spinning Boris, congratulating themselves.
1996. Don't forget about this date, you know. Well, I think it's just a classical case of double standards, you know.
But, you know, it's interesting. You're right, but they don't see it that way. They can't see this far away from their face when it comes to issues like this.
Well, you know, the problem is also with our elite, you know, the response of Russian elite is usually, you are using us in your internal policy struggle. Well, for a totalitarian ideology with global aspirations, which is now reigning in the United States, there is no difference between foreign and domestic policy. Your foreign policy is part of your domestic policy. So, you know, they were trying to
hang
remove
on there,
Mr.
Gents.
Trump.
We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on those 13 Russians. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
All right, gentlemen, let's switch gears here. Let's go back to Syria. Let's go back to the Middle East. Last couple of days, we had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Ankara trying to smooth some feathers. I mean, both countries realize that they're at a crisis point here. After a three-hour meeting with the Turkish President Erdogan, there's the impression, at least, that some kind of agreement was made. I don't get that impression the way it was what was released here. Mark, what was the point of the meeting, and what is the main bone of contention here? Because these are NATO allies, and they're going toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose, in a country, Syria, where neither one of them should be. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, this was obviously for Washington to hold Erdogan's hands, try to reassure him. It's there over their arming of the YPG on Turkish border.
The Kurds,
and owning a large chunk, basically claiming as it of their own, of Syrian territory. Again, much of it right on the Turkish and the Iraqi border. Turkey's extremely upset about this. There were these optics didn't do much, because even as Tillerson was arriving, there was the announcement that the Pentagon is going to be giving another $550 million this year to arm and otherwise support these forces that he's very upset about.
But there has to be a tipping point here, Dima. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Erdogan is invested enormously in this operation here, Olive Branch, unbelievably, that's called Olive Branch.
Yeah, the invasion of Syria.
The invasion of Syria here. I mean, and the United States is not making it very, it's saying, the Pentagon is saying, it will stay in Syria indefinitely against international law here. Something has to go one way or another.
Well, what happened was that the United States indeed kind of provoked Turkey into moving in. That was said by our foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who said...
Because of the support of the Kurds.
Support of the Kurds and, you know, these border security forces that the Americans started talking about.
Didn't tell the Turks.
Exactly. Provoke or provided a pretext
And basically, I don't even understand why Mr. Tillerson is talking to Erdogan, because Erdogan has been saying the same things as Kim Jong-un about the United States in the last 2 weeks. He accused the United States of helping terrorists, you know. Mm. So you can see how desperately the U.S. is trying to preserve its relationship with Turkey.
And let's see, Alex, the background of this is that we have an upcoming meeting in Istanbul with Iran, Turkey, and Russia. It seems to me Erdogan is basically checking out the terrain here, okay? Because the United States is certainly not going to, is not cooperative, at least, in this regard when it comes to the Kurds. It seems to me it's patently obvious that the U.S. wants a statelet. It wants a partition. The Israelis want it. The Saudis are happy with it.
The Turks want it. Their own partition.
And they want their own. And they we have to look at the occupied territory where the U.S. has. This is where the gas fields are for Syria. Again, no money for reconstruction. Okay, but Erdogan is looking at the horizon, and I think he's looking for, maybe he's going into the Grand Bazaar. Go ahead.
These are two illegal invasions of Syria by two NATO allies, which are working at the moment at cross purposes. They are both dangerous for Syria. And I think that is an important point to remember. As for Erdogan, he has to try and balance the fact that he is now in conflict with the United States. So he is now trying to get some kind of arrangement with the Russians and the Iranians to try and balance out the anger that the U.S. has for him.
It's being proposed that the Turks and the Americans work together militarily when the Americans are embedded with the Kurds. That's not going to happen.
This is the problem. But at the same time that he's trying to leverage the Russians against the Americans, he's trying to use the Americans to leverage against the Russians so that he can extract concessions in Syria.
And he can.
His
calculus may be right, because just a few days ago, when the reports about the Turkish army using chemical weapons near Afrin appeared, what was the reaction from the spokesperson for the U.S.-led coalition? The U.S. coalition has no information on this. Whenever there was just a rumor about the Syrian government using chemical weapons, immediately there was an outburst.
They had a lot of rhetoric for something that never, ever happened.
And they didn't even send inspectors there. They were so sure that this information was correct. With Turkey, somehow, they prefer to be silent.
The interesting thing, too, Mark, is that and we have to look at the internal dynamics of Turkey. Erdogan's perceived anti-American stance is very popular
domestically for him. So this is, again, another part of the spectrum that he's playing.
He first of all, he accused the U.S. of a coup trying to overthrow his government, U.S.-backed Gulenists under the bed, probably the only coup that I believe the U.S. hasn't been involved in recent times. But it's enormously popular with his Islamist base, and Erdogan's base is Islamist. That. On top of that, he's turned his country into basically the holiday resort for all of the jihadis across the world who have been debarking into Syria for the last 6 years. If he suddenly does an about face, turns away from Al-Qaeda, turns away from regime change in Syria, he's got to deal with them on his own soil as terrorists.
But he also has to deal with, Alex, is it, again, going back to this meeting with Istanbul with the Iranians, the Russians, and the Turks, is that what Erdogan is doing is wanting to make sure that he's part of some kind of peace process where two countries, Russia and Iran, can play a forceful role, an instrumental role, because the United States is the spoiler, it's the spoiler country, it's not interested in any kind of conflict resolution. That's the other kind of gambit that he's playing.
It is the gap, but he's also trying to use his deals with the Russians to extend his influence into Syria. He's now sending troops into Syria.
He's legitimizing military occupation in Syria with the Astana Agreement.
He's sending troops deep into Idlib province. They're obstructing the Syrian military.
They're doing joint
there.
Patrols openly with Al-Qaeda.
Well, that's the mecca of jihadism now.
Exactly. And of course, he's doing that using this these arrangements that he's made with the Russians and the Iranians to legitimize that. There is another side, because, of course, there's a Russian side. They say, well, we need the cooperation of Erdogan to try and stabilize.
We haven't mentioned one important country yet. I mean, there's a lot of chatter, Dima, that the Israelis are looking for a real, real, meaningful, scary conflict with the Iranians, also with Hezbollah. Do you see this as a part of a puzzle piece right now? Because, you know, that would, and for planners, for American planners in the Pentagon, it would be nice to have a foothold in Syria if an operation like that were to be pulled off.
I prefer to stay on the ground of facts. You know, let's just look at the facts. Israel has been firing missiles on the territory of a sovereign state in the condition of a foreign intervention at the civil war several times.
Over 100 times since 2011.
Exactly. Yes. The Iranians in Lebanon, their embassy was a victim of a huge terrorist act 3 years ago, and no one in the West even expressed condolences, you know. Israel has been occupying Lebanon since 1982, and that was the reason why Hezbollah came into being. It had not existed before. And now Israel, which has been applauding, you know, the foreign interventions in Syria, is concerned about its security and the increased influence of Iran near its border.
But they got a very cold message that the Syrians will start defending their airspace. To what degree that will be put into play, we don't know. I mean, it certainly sent a very powerful message. We don't know to what degree that the Russians or the Iranians were involved in that decision. I tend to think it was Assad saying, hey, this is my country, stop doing it. As Mark said, you know, enough is enough.
But look, you know, we had this media hype this week, you know, Michael Morrow's dream has come true. The Western
Michael
media,
Moore,
exactly, reported, the former head of the CIA, who said things are going to be bad in Syria until we start to kill Russians.
He said we need to kill Russians and Iranians in Syria to make them pay a price for resisting our regime change.
What happened?
Russians have been killed.
What happened was that near these oil-rich areas of Syria, you know, the Syrian government army had a clash with basically illegal armed formations on its territory.
There were no Syrian government
absolutely.
Armed forces.
There were
local tribes,
supposedly Russians and Syrians. So, five Russians got killed. This is what the Russian foreign ministry.
They were contractors.
They were contractors.
Security contractors.
Okay, as if the United States doesn't use Academy, Blackwater, and other contractors. So the Western media tried to make out of it a huge revelation, like something that Putin wants to hide. If anyone in Syria,
what was that? I read it. Putin's pocket army or something.
something like that?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Things
you
like
know,
that.
Alex, you know, one of the things is that, you know, one we keep tabs on in this program is what's going on in Ukraine. And unfortunately, I think we're going to be talking a lot about Ukraine this year. You know, looking at Syria, looking at Ukraine, it, in its totality, it looks like American policy is just pure spite. You know, it's they their regime change in Ukraine didn't work out the way they wanted it because they lost Crimea. They have a frozen conflict that gets warm every once in a while and even hot. And then we have Syria where they lost again.
And Yemen.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I wouldn't call that mature foreign policy because it's, none of it is in America's vested interest.
Well,
go ahead.
It's foreign policy by anger. I think I think anger is perhaps stronger than spite, and I think there is an element of that and of smashing around. But it's also partly, I think, intended to show American power.
Frustration.
But there is an element. There is a certain element of calculation in which the. If you withstand us, you will be hurt. And you see that a lot in Syria, too.
Okay, Mark, for 40 seconds here. I mean, I want to go back to Erdogan and Tillerson. What's your gut feeling? What deal was made or the non-deal that was made?
Yeah, I don't think there was any deal made. Turkey's proposal that they would basically do a joint invasion of Syria,
but that
combine
was
their
But that was rhetorical.
That's not something that's happening on the ground. Going to happen. The U.S. earlier promised Turkey that all of its pet YPG, branded as the SDF, would be withdrawn east of the Euphrates, which means in particular Manbij. This is what Erdogan wants. He wants Afrin, the Drablus corridor, which he already has, and Manbij to form his new chunk of the Ottoman, neo-Ottoman Empire. In fact, he referred to giving the U.S. an Ottoman slap, which if you actually look it up in the Urban Dictionary, you'll find it actually is an indication of complete ineffectualness.
On that very insightful note, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for our extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.